You're listening to Podcast to Practice, brought to you by Springer Health Plus IME. Podcast to Practice brings you expert-led, independent medical education discussions, inspiring healthcare professionals to maximize their learning and make measurable changes in their own clinical practice. This podcast is part of an independent medical education program entitled Awareness Advances Action, Optimizing Outcomes for Patients with Generalized Myasthenia Gravis. It is intended for healthcare professionals and is supported by an independent educational grant from Merck KGaA, Darmstadt, Germany, and UCB, Inc.
Hi, everyone. My name is Kelly Guathme, and I'm a neuromuscular specialist at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Virginia. And it is an honor to be here with you today. And we will be joining Jude Kings for this podcast titled Embracing GMG Advances Together, Ensuring Multidisciplinary Collaboration. This podcast is part of a larger independent medical education program on myasthenia gravis. So the focus of this episode is on the importance of multidisciplinary teams working and improving outcomes in myasthenia gravis. And so again, with me today is Jude Kings. Jude, could you please introduce yourself for our learners?
Yeah. Hi. Thanks, Kelly. So as Kelly said, I'm Jude Kings. I'm a myasthenia specialist nurse and I work at Wessex Neurological Centre, which is in the south coast of England. I qualified as a nurse back in 1996 and I've worked in neurology in various different specialities, in stroke, in complex neurology, since 2001. I have worked in the community, I've worked in hospitals, but for the last 5.5 years, I've taken on this role as a myasthenia specialist nurse. So I work very closely with two consultant neurologists who specialise in myasthenia, and the three of us head up the myasthenia service for the south of the country. My role is very much around supporting patients from diagnosis right the way through to throughout their journey. And that's, you know, providing education and support. And as we'll talk a little bit more around sort of working with the team and coordinating sort of the patient's care and, you know, trying to give them the best possible experience.
Thank you so much for that. You're absolutely the perfect person to be talking to about this topic. And so can you just elaborate a little bit for our learners about how the teamwork can improve patient outcomes for patients with GMG and who these key members are on this multidisciplinary team?
So I think if we were to look at all the different evidence that you'll find that there's actually very limited information out there about the role of the MDT in myasthenia. We know there is a lot of data around the role of the multidisciplinary team in lots of other long-term conditions and specifically neurological ones. And they all agree on the same thing, that with a close working team, with an integrated collaborative approach, that we can help manage every aspect of a patient's health and well-being. We can personalise their care. And ultimately, that leads to increased patient satisfaction, better outcomes for them, it maximises safety. You know, we have to consider that a lot of patients it's a really frightening time for them anyway, just with a diagnosis. But actually, there is a quite a big general lack of knowledge, even within the medical world, around myasthenia. And a lot of patients can find that really daunting, that, you know, even their general practitioners or other specialists might have never heard of myasthenia. So working together as a specialist team, it's about trying to link in with all the other sort of generalists maybe or other specialists in different areas to try and make sure that we can give them, you know, the sort of the maximum care possible. So key members, I mean, I would say, so as I said, in our service, it's two consultant specialists and myself. I think of it as sort of different areas, so that initially it might be we have a neuropharmacist that we link in a lot to. We have a special day unit where we have infusion nurses who might be delivering lots of the treatments. We also work very closely with our thoracic team, so our thoracic surgeons, and we have thoracic case managers, patients who are going for thymectomy. So that's sort of the core one. But then moving much further out, there might be lots of other medical specialities or surgical specialities who patients most, you know, the majority of our patients have comorbidities. So it might be they're also under hematology, or they're under hepatology, or, you know, other different services that we need to be making sure that we're keeping really key communication with them. Women with myasthenia who, you know, are navigating their way through childbirth and pregnancy, we work very closely with the obstetrics team. Obviously, the ward staff and outpatients who are, you know, day-to-day care of patients if they're in hospital or attending clinics, the ophthalmology and orthoptics department, the diagnostics department, you know, with neurophysiology or the path labs or radiology, and then obviously the primary care, so the general practitioners or community services and allied health professionals, whether it's physios, speech and language, occupational therapists. And a big part of it is also the voluntary patient organisations that we work really closely with as well. And all of that together is to try and make sure that every single part of that person's health and well-being is addressed, and, you know, in every which way we can.
That is a very robust team that you work with. That's incredible. I'll say, in my experience, I often will partner with our physical therapists, occupational therapists, respiratory therapists, and social workers pretty routinely in the care of these patients. Do you all, and you mentioned this, but do you have those services available to you in clinic to be seeing these myasthenia gravis patients, or do you refer out to them?
Yeah, unfortunately not in clinic. So we're based in a hospital, in a quite a large teaching hospital. So there are the therapists that are based on the ward. So if someone's either in day, comes into our day unit for treatment, or if they're an inpatient, then they will have access to therapists. Sadly, you know, we would love to expand the service and have a speech and language therapist and physio. It would be brilliant. But unfortunately, we're you know, quite tightly governed by financial strings in the UK with the NHS. So often it may be that if a patient is first in hospital, either whether that's at first point of diagnosis or they're having a relapse that we can't manage in the community, they'll be seen by people, but by therapists. But then when they are back home, it's often referring into community teams. The challenge is, because it's such a rare condition, don't have the specialist knowledge and experience around managing myasthenia. So that's often the biggest challenge.
Thank you. That's extremely helpful context. And also with your team, how do you all create individualized treatment plans for these patients that consider all the different aspects of their condition?
So I think the key thing, it's like with everything, it's about communication, isn't it? So it's about making sure that we're hearing what the patients are saying of what's important to them, but who's involved in their care, and really making sure that everybody's involved. We had a patient recently who we wanted to give rituximab to. He was a gentleman who, Jehovah's Witness, his very high BMI, he was type 2 diabetic, so corticosteroids were not really an option. He also had a history of Crohn's. So it was looking at actually all the different people who were also involved, and, you know, we had lots of conversations. So it's communicating, whether it's through mostly it's clinic letters, you know, so I might see someone in clinic and I will send a clinic letter to finding out who their specialist is and having a look on. If they don't know the name, often on our computer systems, we can find out who they are. Or if not, sometimes there's quite a lot of detective work that needs to go on of phoning around departments, trying to find who the right person is to actually say, look, this is the situation. This is the person we've got. This is the treatment we're considering giving. Actually, we need your take on it. So I guess, how does it work with you and your practice?
I agree. There's a lot of communication that needs to take place. And for us, a lot of it is through the electronic medical record. And so we will send electronic versions of the notes from the office notes when we assess these patients directly to the referring providers, the other specialists, such as the thoracic surgeons you mentioned, that we might be referring our patients to. And even back and forth with some of these outpatient therapists, such as physical therapy, respiratory therapy, social work, and so on. And sometimes, as you say, you do the detective work and you're having a hard time finding the right person to contact. And so then we will place some phone calls. I use have assistance from my nurse navigator in clinic who helps with all of my MG patients. And so she'll help me find the right people to connect with. But you're absolutely right. These treatments have implications for their other medical comorbidities. And so those all have to be taken into consideration. A perfect example, which you alluded to, is when we start a patient on high-dose corticosteroids, and it might affect their blood sugars. And so we really need to partner with the internal medicine doctor, family medicine doctor, endocrinologist to help manage the hyperglycemia that goes along with these treatments that we're giving the patients. And so there is a very close working relationship and partnership across disciplines to really optimize the care of these patients. And so it sounds like we practice in a very similar way in that regard. And so moving on, I was just curious if you feel like there are any barriers that need to be considered that may prevent a patient from accessing new therapies in any given setting.
It's a very specialist area. It's a very rare condition. I wouldn't expect the majority of healthcare professionals to know, particularly with some of the emerging new treatments. And there are lots of new treatments coming out now, which I can just about get my head around, let alone someone who doesn't work just in this field. So a lot of the barriers around whether the patient is accessing a specialist service. So we're in our practice, people are often referred in from out of area because they've been seeing a general neurologist who maybe has sort of tried to manage as best as possible, and then they're referred on to us. So one of the barriers is the lack of awareness and knowledge to a lot of other practitioners, but also lack of patient awareness that they often don't know what they can expect or what should expect, or should they be asking for more treatments, or is it a given that that's the only option I have? And maybe a lack of self-advocacy as well, that patients may not feel that they can be asking those sort of questions. In the UK, we are quite restricted with some treatments, again, because of funding, especially some of the newer treatments. We have to go through quite a robust funding process. A few are being sort of disputed at the moment. It's very time consuming and resource heavy of when it's just myself and a couple of neurologists are having to try and, you know, we have quite a wide range of patients now that we're seeing because they're coming in from all sorts of areas, and we're trying to deliver on a small amount because at the moment, while we're waiting for things to go through funding, it's, you know, things are paid for by pharmaceuticals. So it's slightly different from in the US, I guess, with the NHS funding. But it's, so I think everywhere, wherever you work in the world, it will always be in healthcare that time and resources are always probably one of the biggest challenges. But I would say it's the lack of awareness to non-specialists of what is available and at what point should we be offering, but also even within that of being aware of things like inclusion criterias of what, you know, what options there are, what would be best for the patient.
So we encounter some of the same, you know, obstacles and barriers. I agree with you that there are a lot of general practitioners and general neurologists in the community that might not be as familiar with some of these newer therapeutics. And so may be under-prescribed or even over-prescribed. And so we do get referrals into our specialty clinic from some of these community providers. And so there does need to be some additional education directed toward the patient as well as these community-based providers on the role of these emerging therapeutics. And then you mentioned it. I mean, in the United States, insurance is such a barrier, right? It really dictates in so many cases how we take care of the patient. And there is a significant administrative burden in terms of, you know, kind of appealing denials, peer-to-peer process to try and get some of these therapeutics approved for our patients. And so it does consume a lot of time on the part of the provider, as well as the nursing staff, as well as our pharmacists too, that assist with that process. And I'm curious, you know, in your clinical setting, you know, are there certain strategies that you're employing to ensure that there's continuity of care for these patients and that they get their medications in a timely fashion and get them safely?
I think I'm probably one of the strategies. So my role is very much around trying to coordinate the care. So often it may be the neurologist has seen the patient, has, you know, we've talked through about what the treatment options are. But I tend to be very much the key coordinator, that I'm the one who will be making sure that everybody's happy, the patient has agreed to it all. And then I'm the key link between the pharmacist, you know, some drugs, I'm a non-medical prescriber, so there are some drugs that I can prescribe. Some of the newer therapies are not. I'm leaving that to the neurologist to do. But often I'm the one who then is making sure that there is follow-up in place, that they've got assessments. So that's probably the key sort of the strategies. But again, it's, yeah, making sure that they're not lost, to sort of follow-up.
So, Jude, one of the questions I've been most excited to ask you about is really what your role is in providing education to these patients. Because when I diagnose a patient with myasthenia gravis, or even if they've been diagnosed elsewhere and they're seeing me for the first time, that conversation can take 30 to 45 minutes or even longer to really go over the ins and outs of what myasthenia gravis is, how we treat it, drugs to avoid, things that exacerbate MG. And so I'm just curious about how you approach education in your clinic.
So it's quite a big thing. So often, again, we are aware that you don't have all that time to be able to sit and answer the questions. So often it may be in the clinic that they're given the diagnosis with a bit of a brief explanation. And often I will provide some written information around this is what it is, but also here's my contact number and I will give you a ring. Let's arrange a time. Then often I will try and follow that up with a telephone conversation to talk through what have they understood? What do they want to know? What information do they have access to? I can provide written information. I refer them to the patient organization to make sure that they're accessing that information. It's a key role is about making sure that patients have got access to the right information when they need it. So we use a patient health record, an electronic record that they have access to, which is specifically designated to myasthenia. So when somebody's firstly diagnosed, we register them to it, and it has links to the charity pages, that there's lots of information on there about what is myasthenia, what treatment options there are. We have shared decision making sort of things on there. So it might be that we say, right, we're going to start on prednisolone, and then, or we're going to, you know, go for this drug or try this drug, but actually you go ahead and read about it and then we'll discuss it more. So again, it's like everything, limited with time and resources, but I'm aware that I do have more time and, to be able to deliver that rather than just within a clinic. So I work in joint clinics with the neurologist, but I also run my own clinics. So I try to do a lot of the follow-ups of patients who've been newly diagnosed. I try and follow them up ideally within a week or two that they've been diagnosed, depending on how they are when we first see them in clinic. Some people, it's very clear that they need a phone call, you know, within the first week, or also depending on what their symptoms are. It's information not just about medication, what myasthenia is, but the whole package, as you're aware, isn't it? It's about how do you manage this condition? What can you expect? What do you do in a relapse? It's about educating on so many different levels, isn't it? It's not just about saying this is the condition, this is what it's about, but it's about helping them to understand that this is a lifelong condition, that they need to learn how to self-manage ultimately in the long term.
It's incredible. You're really providing comprehensive support to these patients, I'm sure caregivers and family members as well. And so in addition to that educational role that you have, you know, day in and day out when patients aren't doing well, for example, can you explain a little bit more to our learners how you support these patients?
So as I said, that any person with a new diagnosis, I'm given, they're given my contact details as the first point of contact. So they will contact me if they're having any problems, any signs of a relapse, they're not getting on with their medication. And sometimes you can't always assess that over the phone. So I might need to bring them into a clinic so that I can actually really see what's going on. But there will be lots of advice that I might give around medication, or sometimes it ends up being, you know, it's more general health advice or lifestyle advice, that anything that can try and help this patient manage as best as possible as they can at home without needing to bring them in.
Yes, we teach our patients to always either check the list of contraindicated medications or reach out to us anytime a provider is trying to prescribe a new medication. And so my nurse navigator or I get calls all the time or email messages about that. And it's good. We've had a lot of near misses, right, of certain antibiotics that were prescribed to our patients that they shouldn't have taken. And so, you know, layering in that support really does make a difference.
Yeah, it does. It does. And I think, yeah, it's continual though, isn't it? That you might talk to somebody about that and then there'll be something else, or, you know, but it's it's trying to give them the skills and the knowledge that they can learn to manage their condition. And I always feel like initially it might be that, I always think that sort of the first year, particularly of diagnosis, that's the hardest, when I might get lots of phone calls from somebody. But often, you know, down the line, that people are, once they've learned, actually, this is normal, this is, I can manage this, this is okay, I know what I need to do. But they always know that they can contact me if there's any questions or concerns.
Excellent. So Jude, it's just been so wonderful having you. And in the last moment or two, I just wanted to see if you can sort of summarize the take-home points for our learners on this topic of multidisciplinary care in myasthenia gravis.
So I think I'd probably say that it's recognizing that each individual comes with their whole health and well-being. It's not just looking at that person as somebody who's got myasthenia. It might be somebody who's also got other comorbidities, but even without that, it's about recognizing them from a social point, a religious point, all of the package that comes with each individual, and to be able to give strive to give the best possible care to try and reduce their anxiety, to help maximize their potential and give them, you know, the best possible outcome. It's trying to tap into every single member of the team that we can, because lots of people may find that they, you know, lots of other clinicians won't have the understanding about myasthenia, won't have the knowledge about the new emerging treatment. So it's about being able to reach out to everybody and saying, look, this is what's going on, this is what the patient is struggling with, this is what we need to do, actually, let's all work together to try and give them the best possible care. So I think it's educating the patient, but also educating the rest of the wider team of, you know, I sing from the rooftops about myasthenia, of saying this is, you know, what we do, and this is what we need to do to support our patients.
That's excellent. I just want to say thank you once again to Jude Kings for joining us for this video podcast titled Embracing GMG Advances Together, Ensuring Multidisciplinary Collaboration. I'd also like to thank our audience and really encourage everybody to listen to all the video podcasts in this series called Myasthenia Gravis Disease Dialogues, and download the clinician and patient resources on the program website. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Podcast to Practice, brought to you by Springer Health Plus IME. For more information on our educational programs available, visit ime.springerhealthplus.com.